It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 209, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, AI poisoning, YouTube privacy consequences, vigilante apps, and the Beatles.
Good afternoon, Gary. How's life in Denver?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Nice here. Calm before the winter.
Yeah. We've been experiencing an above average amount of rain. So it's been windy and rainy, and I ended up having to test my generator just in case. We have a generator that, you know, runs the, if we have a prolonged outage, I want something that will keep the refrigerator and freezer running.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's the highest cost of failure when we run out of power. So, you know, for any prolonged period of time. Fortunately, it's been a long time. Power grid out here has been relatively stable for some time, but didn't always used to be that way.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I've never set anything like that up.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No, we've got the whole transfer panel next to our circuit breakers and all that stuff. Yeah, it's interesting for sure. Hmm. Things behave differently when they're on a generator as well. So, I've got some random things I came up with this week. The one that I want to start with is I've seen a couple of articles on it. Basically, there's a new technique that promises to make poison photographs for AI consumption. So by that, I mean, there's apparently something that they can do to the photographs that causes the AI scanners that, you know, consume all this stuff to build their database of what pictures look like, causes them to get confused in some very interesting and significant ways, I guess, all with the promise of not actually affecting the image to the human eye. There's something else going on. And the first thing that came to my mind, of course, was this is probably some form of steganography where they're embedding some data of some sort into the image in such a way that, once again, you know, you don't see it, I don't see it, but the AI learning modules do see it and react poorly to it. If it looks like an image to the human eye, I have a hard time understanding how that wouldn't necessarily still look like an image to the AI consumption tools.
Sure.
But they claim that it does. And, you know, I'm not necessarily really interested in this particular instance of AI detection or AI poisoning, as they call it. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in the broader topic. And that is, you know, is deepfake detection, is AI image detection, is AI writing detection, and to whatever degree is AI poisoning by putting in, you know, data that causes the AI to go kind of nuts, is that sustainable? Mm-hmm. My thinking is that it's absolutely not. That at some point, whatever technique they're using today will be overcome by somebody's large language model. Whatever technique they're using today for images will be overcome by some image parser. I don't want to necessarily call it a game of whack-a-mole. I think it's more an arms race where, you know, as one side, the AI creators gets more powerful, and the image originators, the authors and the artists, get more concerned and bring more tools to bear to make their products or their creations less consumable. I just see both sides continuing in this escalating war. Now, the interesting part is that the AI consumers, the folks that make large language models, the folks that make things like DALL-E 3 and so forth, for the most part, they're the white hats in this scenario, in the sense that at some point, somebody's going to agree on some rules. you know, you can consume these images, but you can't consume these images. Or here's a way to indicate that you're allowed to parse this, and here's a way you're allowed, you know, to indicate that you can't. And in fact, I believe there's already a standard for a file you can put on a website called AI.txt that basically says, you know, this is what you're allowed to look at, and this is what you're not allowed to look at when you're building your large language model database. But as with all cases like that, that keeps the good guys in line. The bad guys are going to do whatever the heck they want.
Yeah.
And they're the ones, I think, that are really going to be pushing the envelope on sidestepping, thwarting any and all attempts at AI detection. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about that a fair amount because, you know, I've been using a fair amount of AI the past couple of weeks, mostly image generation because it's kind of fun. And I've been impressed with the results, but I don't really understand how, you know, the folks who created the original images that feed these models can do anything about it. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It reminds me a little bit. There's a TV show. I may have mentioned it in years past, called The Capture. It's a British TV show where it's actually video, like using AI to change video surveillance feeds live to, you know, is basically implicate somebody in a crime. And there's all the evidence on video of everything they need to, you know, and the person's like, I didn't do it. I wasn't there. I was, you know, and it was like, well, we have all this evidence.
Right.
And somebody was putting themselves in the middle there, you know, being able to fake this stuff, it gets better. And then, you know, attempts to detect the fakes are going to get better. And it's like an arms race. It is kind of funny, you know, that you said like the white hat stuff, like, cause I've tried to make fun things for my stuff. And there's all this like watermarking and everything. And it's like, but I'm not trying to, and I'm not making anything and trying to pass it off as something else. I'm making like, it's just for fun. It's just a funny image to accomplish, you know, to accompany, like you do, like to accompany a topic.
Yep, absolutely. You know? In fact, I usually give attribution to the AI model that I happen to do it from. I'm not seeing watermarks, but my assumption is, and I haven't looked, that the metadata for the image probably contains.
Probably does, yeah. And now I think also too, it's like if you're trying to poison an image, like my first thought, like if I tried to feed an image into like an AI thing, maybe just do something simple. Maybe like I want to identify, oh, it's a picture outside. Where is this? You know, this is like a city block. What city is it? Oh, AI might be able to tell me. I feed it in and it like can't tell what's going on because something's embedded in the image. My first thought would be to take it through and filter the image. Like apply like the 1% blur that you can't even really detect.
And change the
color, right? Make it take a little bit of the color out and highlights and stuff. Make it it's just a slightly different image. And I'm thinking when it reprocesses all the pixels for that, even just export it as a JPEG. You know, and let it compress, you know. And my thinking is eventually I'll hit on something that will remove whatever is there in the pixels and suddenly it looks like a normal image again. Now, how hard is it for the AI to do that by itself? Like the first step is you do it. And then it's like as soon as you figure out, oh, all you need to do is export this as a 60% JPEG and it works every time. So now just tell the AI, hey, every time I send you an image for analysis, just immediately make it a 60% JPEG and then analyze it.
It's funny because I've thought about various ways of thwarting the various things that that I've heard suggested. The metadata one, for example, is such an easy one to remove. There are tools that will remove it, or worst case, a decent screenshot.
basically
start all over with no metadata or different metadata.
The screenshot one is the one that bothers me the most because it'll work even in the situation I was talking about, right? Because you're scaling it on your screen and all that. And so you take a screenshot and it works. The infuriating part is you still want to, you know, yell at anybody doing it. No, you're doing it wrong. You should run it through a filter or do something much more complex. What you're doing is wrong. It's the same thing I wanted to yell at kids when I was young that would want to copy music from one cassette to another by putting a microphone in front of a speaker.
Oh.
I'd be like, you're doing it wrong. And they're like, we don't care. I get the song on my cassette. Now I can listen to it in my car. Yeah. And it's like, but you're doing it wrong. It's the same thing. Take a screenshot and now it goes through AI just fine. No, you're doing it wrong. You need an algorithm. You need to pass it through and do a Gaussian blur at, you know, 1 degree or whatever, you know. So
yeah. So yeah, anyway, like I said, the article that spurred this this thought on my, you know, this line of thinking for me, it's called A Clever Shield Against Photo Fakery in the MIT Tech Review. And it is essentially that first thing I talked about where they've come up with this algorithm to throw poisoning data into the image that presumably will confuse the AIs. Like I said, I just see it as not even necessarily the first step, but an early step in an arms race.
Yep.
So, that's what I wanted to cover there.
Cool. I saw a story that's really interesting because if you're like a fan of YouTube or you go on YouTube a lot, you may have seen a story over the last couple of months where YouTube is cracking down on ad blockers. So this has been like, you know, YouTube ad blockers are a whole thing. Like people have web ad blockers, and some are very specific about just blocking the ads on YouTube. People want to watch stuff on YouTube and they don't want to have to see the ads. And they were, you know, an ad blocker on a website is just looking for like a block on the page that is showing an ad. And they know it's showing an ad because it's coming from some ad server, right?
Right.
And they just have it be a white space instead. But on YouTube, there's a whole streaming thing where there's a video player and it's inserting ads, you know, before and during the video. And so having an ad blocker that basically tricks the video player into not showing those ads or skipping them immediately or whatever. It's a whole thing, but people who watch a lot of YouTube will either, you know, it's try to find one of these and work hard to get it going or pay for them, which always upsets me because it's like, well, you could pay YouTube just to take the ads off. Mm-hmm. And then the creators actually get, you know, more than half of the ad money. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you could do that and actually be paying the people that are like creating the videos you're watching, or you could pay an ad blocker and that's just going to the person that made the ad blocker, not the person who's actually like the video you're watching. But anyway, YouTube has been kind of upping their game a bit because it's not hard technically to detect if an ad blocker is running, especially if you own the site, right? If you own all the tech behind the site, I mean, right. You could just simply say, show the ad. Oh, wait a minute. It's 1 second later and the 15-second ad is over. No, you didn't see it. You must be doing something, right?
Right.
Or like if it's just not loading, or if they just basically say, here's the player code. Oh, let me check the player code. Oh, wait a minute. The player's been altered. You know, right. I know it's been altered because it's my player. And then the website can go and say, okay, you're running an ad blocker. And it's an arms race where it's really easy for YouTube to win as long as they devote a little bit of effort to it. Because mm-hmm. all they got to do is look for the next ad blocker to come up, figure out what it's doing, put some, you know, a new detection thing in there, and then just tell the person, oh, you've got something going on in your browser and you can't watch this. Well, there's been an interesting aspect of this that has come out. And that is that some people in the EU are now suing over the fact that YouTube's detection of ad blockers is a violation of privacy. The idea being that somebody, it's got an ad blocker on their machine and YouTube is detecting that they've got that ad blocker. Hey, you can't, you know, violate the user's privacy to tell what they've got going on their browser. Right. So I looked into it. I'm like, yeah, you know, technically that actually is a violation of privacy. I didn't think of it like that. And there's actually a part of the EU privacy law that they say it is specifically violating.
Interesting.
And so that YouTube can't do this. They can't violate the user's privacy by detecting whether or not they have an ad browser. Now, this is very frustrating because YouTube's, you know, it's YouTube's site, right? So you think they should be able to go and say, hey, here's some videos. You just got to watch the ads or pay us for premium and you don't have to watch the ads. And then some other people come along and say, well, I'm not going to abide by that agreement. I'm just going to watch the videos. I'm not going to watch your ads. And then YouTube says, well, then you're not allowed to view the site. You know, that's the conditions of the site. In order to see if they're violating that condition, they have to violate the user's privacy. That's super frustrating because there's so many conflicting things,
right.
You know, the user's right to privacy, but also YouTube's right to, you know, say this is what our site is, and you know, these are our terms for our site. Plus the fact that in the middle of the whole thing are the creators, who I happen to know, they get slightly more than 50% of that ad revenue, right? So really is, I mean, I think people have the impression that YouTube might get like 98% of it, and like a trickle goes to a creator, which is true for a lot of other services.
Yes.
But YouTube, it's not true. YouTube does give a big portion to the creators, which is why you've got successful YouTube channels, right? Right. They're not all cat videos and stolen stuff. They're people that actually like get hit videos and then keep making those videos, whether they're, you know, making, you know, fun videos or lifestyle videos or science videos or whatever
it is.
Tech
videos, yes.
Tech videos, yeah. they're doing that. The reason they, when you see a channel that is doing good, it's because they're doing that because they're making a living off of doing it, or at least part of their living. And, but you know, the ad blockers kind of take that away. So that is, it's a really perplexing kind of paradox of issues of privacy meets ad blocking meets, you know, creators making money off of the creation, you know, creator economy meets like, you know, big tech, you know, in this case, Google. And there is a solution to it. There's a solution to it that I thought of immediately, and it's a solution that scares me. The solution, of course, is that YouTube stops showing videos on the web and just shows them in their app. Because that's why there isn't a problem like this for, say, something like TikTok or Instagram, because it's all in an app. They control the environment completely.
Interesting.
So you don't have ad blockers for those. Technically, there's still things you could do to block ads, but web ad blocking is a whole different thing.
Right.
So I'm afraid that, well, if they go and they say, yep, you can't detect ad blockers, and Google has to say, well, we give up with that. So in order to protect our revenue, we're just going to remove YouTube.com, and you have to actually use the YouTube app.
Interesting.
On whatever platforms. And that scares me because we're web guys. We grew up with the, you know, the web. I mean, the web is like, it's like the ultimate freedom, right? It's like anybody can create a website. I can create a website in 5 minutes and have it up there. I can't create an app in 5 minutes, and I've got gatekeepers for the different stores the app has to go into. Mm-hmm. But a website is like real, like tech democracy, right? Create a website. So having a part of the web die, like a maybe the most popular site on the web, at least one of the top two or three, because of a privacy rule.
So,
you know,
the implication, by the way, is that on platforms where they do have an app,
yeah,
i.e. mobile,
yeah,
the ad blockers don't work.
Right.
It's interesting because a lot of it in my I don't know. It doesn't make it right, but YouTube, in a sense, has been doing this to themselves. And I say that because I purchased YouTube Premium, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and I've been paying for it ever since. And it is honestly some of the best money I've ever spent. And I say that because, well, two reasons. One, I get to share it with a limited number of accounts. Mm-hmm. So I immediately shared it with my wife's account, and now she doesn't have to look at ads either. But the ads, there just were so many of them, mm-hmm. You know, at the beginning, and then they started inserting them into the middle. You know, I mean, yes, I understand that that's how they need to pay for the service. And you and I specifically, we benefit from that. Just as we do benefit from the premium subscribers. But the folks who don't want to or can't afford to pay for it, I understand the frustration. I really do. I don't know what the solution is, to be honest. I really don't know what the solution is other than something like YouTube Premium. You know, that's the only one that makes sense, quote unquote, legally. I was wondering if, obviously, it's been a long time since I've been through onboarding with YouTube. I suppose I could create another account somewhere and see what it looks like. But before you start viewing YouTube, mm-hmm. I assume you have to agree to some terms of service. And it seems like the whole GDPR thing would be rendered moot if part of what you were agreeing to was allowing YouTube to examine what else is going on in your browser. Way, you know, it's
but ideal. That doesn't help. It doesn't help if the EU has laws against it.
Well, so what the question is, what is the law against, right? It's against perhaps unknowingly giving away your privacy. But if you explicitly give someone permission to do something, is that still against their law? And obviously there it really does boil down to the specific wording of the law. But my assumption is that, you know, we give YouTube and Google permission to do things all the time, right? Whenever you link, say, your YouTube account with one of the many YouTube creator tools, one of the very first things you do is you log in with Google and it tells you, hey, you're about to give this application these additional permissions. They can do everything to your account, right? And you say yes. So you've just given away a big bucket of privacy to like a third-party app. Well, how is Google any different in that sense if they're looking at what's going on in your browser after you've given them permission to do so? Mm-hmm. Obviously, like I said, it depends on the wording of the of both the terms of service, which I haven't seen forever, and I don't know that I'd want to read from cover to cover anyway, and the wording of the GDPR. Ditto, actually. I don't want to read that either. Yeah. But it just seems like there are a few potential outs for YouTube along the way. One of the things I was thinking of as you were talking about this is this reminds me so much of a couple of tools used for Facebook, Social Fixer and Fluff Busting Purity. These are browser extensions that basically allow you to customize the YouTube web feed more along the lines of what you want. And yes, both of them do things like remove the ads from your feed. They also allow you to do things like change the behavior, have it always revert, you know, display the reverse chronological instead of the algorithm. There's a bunch of different features in each of these tools. And one of the things that they're constantly fighting with is, in fact, the arms race or the whack-a-mole, in that Facebook will make a change to the way it displays things on the web page, and it'll break these tools. And then the authors of these tools will be scrambling to figure out a new way to make it work with the current iteration of Facebook's code. And it'll work again for a while. And then Facebook will break it again. How much of that is intentional? I have no idea. But the bottom line is it's still kind of sort of the same thing. These are extensions, third-party extensions that are intended to remove the advertising mostly from tools like Facebook. So YouTube, it'd be interesting if YouTube loses in GDPR in Europe, what implications that might have for other software.
Yeah, no, definitely. And the web. And yeah. So it's interesting, something to keep an eye on. I think every time I think of like GDPR, I'll also think of like how not unusable, that's an exaggeration, but you go to websites, you know, since that, and you get hit with those boxes accepting, you know, all cookies or customize, you know. So if you don't want to accept all cookies, sometimes you have to customize and spend a good deal of time, like turning all the switches off,
right?
And then saying, this is what I want. Or just even if it's, you know, making a decision there, it's like, I'm sure they really didn't have that in mind, that the entire internet, every website you go to would be behind these, you know, selection boxes that you have to read. Yep. And it's made it the web a much worse experience, especially if you do research, right? Because the problem with research is you're going from site to site to site. It's one thing to go to one site and spend hours there. But if you're saying, I want to research something, I'm going to Google this, like a tech thing, and now I'm going to all these different websites, and every single one of them is presenting me with a, you know, what cookies do I want to accept kind of deal.
It's interesting there, which actually dives into the fact that there are now browser extensions that will automatically answer those things for you.
No, so I haven't seen that.
You don't actually see them, right? No. just because they've become that annoying. They are, in my opinion, totally ineffectual, because what do people do? They say, make this go away. They don't make informed decisions of what the EU originally intended these things to do. And the fact is, every site uses cookies. So basically, forcing every site to tell you that it uses cookies is really stupid. really stupid. And I don't know. The other thing I was going to mention is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Google AdSense, one of the advertising networks, I believe that they are going to require that you have this kind of consent mechanism on your site in order to display or monetize your site using Google AdSense. So it's only going to get worse.
Yeah. Indeed.
All right. One of the other things I ran across this week is an article in the Washington Post called "Use Find My Phone Apps, But Don't Trust Them." And I found it fairly interesting. We've talked about, Find My Devices and, Apple's little device, the thing we were talking about a couple of episodes ago about maybe putting on some of the equipment we've got for my nonprofit and being able to see where it went. There are a couple of stories in this article where people have done that. They've had their phone stolen. They've used Find My Device, and they've basically gone vigilante. And there's at least one person who set fire to the house that was indicated as containing his iPhone. The only problem is it wasn't the right house. The actual location was wrong. And I think that the comment that the article makes, and I think it's a very good one, is we have been trained by these location tools to more or less believe them. They're actually pretty good. When I can see when I can see where in the grocery store my wife is based on my Google Maps, that's actually pretty cool, pretty accurate, right? But the important thing that I think a lot of people don't remember is that that level of accuracy is not in any way, shape, or form guaranteed. And depending on the environment, depending on the situation, the location determining technologies, of which actually there are three, can sometimes have a margin of error on the order of miles. It's not uncommon for me to see a friend of ours, normally her icon is right at home, right where you expect it. And then every once in a while, she's instantly 5 miles west. And we don't know why. We don't know what it is. But there are, like I said, there's basically three things that combine to come up with the location. GPS, of course, is what everybody thinks of. And GPS, its accuracy depends on how many satellites your phone is able to actually hear from. And that can get, I think, as close as 1 or 3 meters. I forget, but that's like the highest resolution. And that's actually pretty darn good. However, it's impacted by, like I said, the number of satellites. And if you are in a place with a lot of either electrical interference, if you're living in a Faraday cage, in other words, you're living in an aluminum building or aluminum frame building, there's a lot of, I know that it can be difficult when you're out in the wild, if you're under a lot of trees, those can act as deterrents. So the accuracy can go way, way down. And of course, most of these tools don't really have a display of exactly what the margin of error is currently for the number of GPS satellites they happen to connect to. There are apps on your phone that will tell you that, but they're certainly not the default apps. They're certainly not the mapping apps or the Find My apps. The other two of the other things that are used then are Wi-Fi hotspots. We've talked about this long ago. Essentially, there's a, I guess you'd call it a database of some sort of this Wi-Fi with this SSID or maybe this MAC address or maybe who knows what lives here. so that as you're moving about, if your phone encounters, doesn't even have to connect to it, but if your phone encounters that Wi-Fi hotspot, then it kind of sort of knows your location. You're close to that Wi-Fi hotspot. So that's another technique they use. And then, of course, there's always the cell towers, right? The stuff you see in detective or police shows all the time. It's like, okay, fine, you've got a cell phone. We've been able to ping it from this tower, which means it's here. And now we've been able to ping it from a second tower, which means it's got to be here. And, you know, if we're lucky and we actually can triangulate on it, then, you know, maybe we can get really, really close. But like I said, in each of those cases, there is this margin of error that is, maybe it's not necessarily common, but it is absolutely possible. And it is possible, I think, more often than people realize. And that's what's leading to this kind of stuff. And it's not just people out for vengeance trying to find their phone and take it out on whoever stole it. There have absolutely been reports of police activity that have relied on this kind of information and gotten it wrong.
Oh, sure.
The information, you know, they followed the information that they were given, but the information simply was wrong and they didn't understand that there was this margin of error. So, you know, the big takeaway here, of course, is, yeah, use it. I mean, if you lose your phone, use Find My Phone. You'll get some idea of at least where it is. If you're using AirTags to track your luggage, great. If you find out that your luggage made its way to South Africa, the AirTag isn't what's going to give you your luggage back. Don't get your hopes up that much, but it is useful information to provide to the people who could actually do something properly. And hopefully they understand the limits of what to expect out of this stuff. The bottom line is just don't trust them.
Yep. I think I talked about this before on the show. I definitely talked about it in a video I did.
Right.
But this idea I came up with of if you find a lost phone, right? Because I'm thinking you're burning the house down kind of thing. Like the situation could arise where you're walking down the street and you see somebody's phone and right. You want to be the good guy. So yeah, pick up the phone and you say, great, I'm going to keep the phone safe. And hopefully, because it's, maybe it's locked, right? So there's nothing you could do. Hopefully they've got tracking. And they could find the phone. Matter of fact, I'm going to take it home and I'm going to plug it in to keep it charged, right?
Right.
So they can continue to track it. And you think you're the good guy. But what you may not consider is the other side is they may not realize they dropped the phone.
Right.
They may get home and say, somebody stole the phone.
Right.
I'm going to track it. Ah, I found out where it is. This is where the thief may be. So you're under the impression you're the good guy, keeping the phone charged, hoping they show up. And they're under the impression that you're somebody that stole their phone.
Right.
So my solution, and I've never had to use this, but I thought if I ever had to, I would put a piece of paper on the door that they would, go up to saying, I found your phone. I found it on, wherever in such right. and such park or on whatever street. I'm keeping it here and charged. If this is your phone, just, I don't know. You could direct whatever you want from there. The big part is if they show up thinking they're going to confront you or they show up with police.
Right.
And they see that note, it disarms the situation.
One would hope.
Well, yeah. Well, because you would look at it and say, well, maybe they're doing that to fake me out. It's like, but why would they do that? Right. Why, if they're that aware of the whole situation, you wouldn't put a sign on your door. And at least it makes them think they might be completely in the world of somebody stole my phone.
Right.
No other possibility is out there. And at least when they see this note, they say, well, wait a minute.
Hopefully maybe there isn't a possibility. They'll find that before they burn down the house next door.
I would hope that they would go to the door at least, look at the door and say, is this the right address or whatever?
They don't know it's your door, right? I mean, if Find My is off by a house or two.
Oh, yeah. If it's off by a house or two, then yeah.
You could walk up to the house next door.
I guess don't burn somebody's house down because
obviously, yes.
But, don't commit a crime to try to correct a crime.
Vigilantism doesn't pay. Yes.
Yeah, because even if the person is an actual thief who stole your phone,
right.
You still shouldn't burn their house down.
Right.
Because please. That's still illegal.
My thinking is that if I were to find a phone somewhere, I would just bring it to the police.
Well, actually, it's what I talk about in the video. This is from a few months ago. The first thing I say, because I researched it, I wanted to figure out what the right thing to do was.
Okay.
And the problem with bringing you to the police is it depends where you live, right? I mean, I'm sure there are places where you can bring it to the police and, you know, everybody knows everybody and it's great. And at least the city I live, and I think in a lot of other cities, it's not going to do anything. It's going to, first of all, where do you even take it? And if the other person discovers it, like discovers they've lost their phone, they're probably not going to think, where's the local precinct? You know, they're not going to do that.
Well, find my phone will show that it's near the police station, at least.
Maybe. I mean, it's probably much less of a chance to find my phone to work inside a police station where it may be thrown into a closet or a box or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, you know, the police station, I think, is the most likely place for you to walk in. The phone could be literally right under the desk. And you ask the person behind the desk, I lost my phone. Has anybody turned in a phone? And then just say, I don't know. I got work to do. You know, we're solving murders and stuff. We don't have time to find your lost phone.
We're busy dealing with this house that's on fire. Yes.
Or just that simply it's like, I'm the person on desk on duty this hour. Right. Mm-hmm. If it didn't get turned into me, I have no idea where it would be. So police, I ruled about it's basically my conclusion in the video was if possible, turn it into the nearest authority figure, like the host at a restaurant or a waiter at a restaurant or a school, the main office, wherever it is. Think like the person who, first of all, assume that the person who lost the phone remembers where they lost it or at least has a short list. Oh, I went to this store, this restaurant, and then home. So they have a short list. And then think if they went back to that location, where's the first place they would go, right? They would ask somebody on the staff there or on the office of the school or the front desk of an office building or wherever it is. Think about that. It's usually like the nearest kind of like connected to the location person that there is and turn responsibility over to them. Hey, I found this phone in your restaurant. I found this phone in your office building. The person may come back. And that's actually not only, I think, a good thing to do, but it's also the most likely to be almost an instant return. Like you could do that and 2 minutes later, the person could be like, hey, did anybody turn in the phone? Whereas like a police precinct or something in a city, it's like, I mean, if they even show up, how much longer would that be? Anyway, that's getting off the topic.
But it's actually a good solution in general, just because this is all about find my devices, not necessarily being as accurate as we think. But if you suddenly realize that find my phone is showing it like, at a business that's next door to the restaurant you just had lunch at.
Yeah.
Okay. That'll trigger your memory. And then you'll head back to the restaurant and ask them or whatever.
Yeah. And there's a lot of advantages to it. So, and actually the original, thing that made me think of that is I was boarding a flight and somebody actually found a phone on a chair, right in front of where we were boarding. And they did a weird thing, which was not the worst thing to do, is they kind of called out, anybody left their phone on this chair? Anybody? And I'm thinking, well, half the flight is boarded at this point, so they're probably on the plane. But then he stood there and he held the phone up in the air, like in an awkward way that you would be like, why is that guy have his hand up? Oh, he's holding a phone. If you just lost your phone, or even if you did lose your phone, the first thing you do is like grab your pocket. Yeah. Is my phone there? Yeah. And I thought that was a good idea. But a better idea was he was like 5 feet away from the flight attendant checking people in.
Right.
Just go over there and hand it to her, because not only would that be the first place I would go to and say, oh, is anybody turning in a phone? But if the entire flight boards, she's the person that could go walk down there and say, hey, somebody left a phone behind on the, you know, in the waiting area.
Right.
Anyway, so
it's funny because that scenario actually is less and less likely these days, mostly because with electronic boarding passes, you just can't get on the plane without your phone.
Oh, I don't know. I still see so many. We're all there with our phones with the, you know, the code showing on them.
Yes.
Although it is kind of weird if you think about it. I mean, boarding an airplane, that should be like at the forefront to all the technology, not only because they've got so much technology there anyway, but it'd be easy to standardize and upgrade things. I'm still using a visual code on the screen, right? You have to actually put the phone on the scanner.
Yep.
I went to a concert, a comedy show last week, and I was surprised when I brought my Apple Wallet up that usually will show a code.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't show a code. It just said, here's your ticket. Hold close to the scanner. I was like, oh, NFC. Yep. You know, I was like, I haven't seen an NFC. I know this was possible, but this venue, it was NFC. And sure enough, you just kind of waved your phone close to the little thing the guy was holding and it beeped. And that thing I liked about it is it's for everybody. Everybody had their phones out and they were doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fast. It was much faster than the getting the code visually over the little thing.
Right.
This was like beep, beep, beep. Everybody's just going through. It was really nice. So, but airlines, no, it'll probably be 10 years before we see that for boarding planes.
Honestly, I'm happy with where they are right now. It's so much better than paper.
Yeah, it's better than a lot of the other stuff. Yep. So, yeah.
So, several episodes ago in TEH 197, we discussed the controversy, if you will, about at that time was an upcoming release of the quote unquote last song by the Beatles.
Yes.
They were going to be using AI technology of some sort to essentially recover John Lennon's voice from a recording that he had made, one of the last recordings that he had made with the intent of releasing it as a Beatles song. At the time, we were saying, no, it's not. They're not deep faking John Lennon's voice. They are essentially extracting his voice from the recording and getting rid of all the other things, the guitar and the whatever else he's singing over.
Piano, I think, mostly, yeah.
So that song released publicly, I think it was last week, and I listened to it.
Mm-hmm.
Before I go into it, what'd you think of it? I'm sure you've heard it. What'd you think of it?
Of course. Yeah. Well, you know me, I'm a huge Beatles fan. It was interesting. I mean, it's basically the part of there were three songs, on that tape that were made into Beatles songs, but they were, 20 years ago, they made the first two. And Free as a Bird, you may remember that one. That was from 1994, before George Harrison passed away.
Mm-hmm.
The three Beatles got together and made those, but they couldn't make one out of Now and Then because of they couldn't separate the voice enough with the technology that they used. So, but then 20 years later, and it was after Peter Jackson made Get Back, and they used all the technology to work on the audio that they had for those films. Paul basically sent the cassette to him, or to that team at least,
right,
and said, can you separate the vocals out of this with that same software you were using? And they did so in seconds and sent it back. So then Paul and Ringo said, okay, well, let's finish that song then. That was an outstanding thing we had. We'll finish that. And fortunately, the cool thing is because they worked on it some back in 1994, whenever it was, with George actually recorded some guitar for it before they gave up on the song. So they not only had John's recording of his vocal, but they had George's recording of some guitar from that, when they were trying to do the song in the first place. So it really is a all four Beatles collaboration.
That's kind of cool.
It's a good, I was surprised because I'm a huge Beatles fan. I listen to Beatles all the time. And this isn't even the last time we'll be talking about the Beatles in this podcast.
Yes.
I was surprised that after I gave it one listen and thought, okay, yeah, I didn't expect it to be a hit or anything, that I was able to actually hear myself, especially John's vocal going on in my head afterwards.
It's interesting. So did you watch the video?
Yeah, I watched the video and the documentary. There's a short documentary on Apple Music.
I have not watched the documentary, but I did watch the music video.
And 15-minute documentary.
It was interesting to see a couple of things. One is they had, present day Paul and Ringo with, literally on screen at the same time as older snippets of video from John and George. But very slowly throughout the video, especially at the end, Paul and Ringo get younger and younger and younger.
Oh, yeah, okay.
At the very end, right, they got some of the oldest photos of them, holding instruments at any rate. So you can just see them progressively getting younger. Yeah. My take on the music itself is, yep, that's the Beatles. It definitely sounds like the Beatles. It didn't move me the way that it seems to have moved some people. If you read the YouTube comments on the video, there's some folks that really, really took it, deep, deep to heart. I would call it pleasant and nostalgic, but as you said, it's not going to be like a Billboard Top 100 or anything like that.
Yeah, it was just a nice thing to do. And I'm always welcome any Beatles stuff. I mean, yeah, the Beatles industry, I'm a huge fan, but I still recognize that there's a big industry and that things are pretty well thought out in terms of like every year or so. There's, the last, 2 years ago was Get Back, the movie, 8-hour movie or whatever. There's constantly things being put out there for Beatles fans because there are a ton of Beatles fans. And you want to keep things going. I mean, it's the same thing with any kind of artistic universe, whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek or, novels, books by various people and all that. There's a constant, the Harry Potter universe, constant little things coming out all the time.
One thing that I thought was kind of cute at the end of the video, years ago, you remember the controversy because the record label that they used was Apple.
Yes.
And I forget who sued who. I think they sued Apple Computer, Lost or something like that.
Yeah.
But now at the end of the video, it is copyright Apple Corp. As in Corp.
Yeah.
Which I thought
was always that.
Was it?
Apple Corp. Yeah, there are Apple Corp. And then it was Apple Computer. And then there was the original lawsuit, I believe, was resolved with Apple Computer giving Apple Corp money and agreeing to never get involved in the music industry, which they broke pretty quickly. and the funny thing was, is I remember when the original agreement came out and it seemed reasonable. And then a few years later, it became like Max started to have the ability to like edit audio. So it was like crossing over a bit. And then the MP3 revolution happened, right?
Right, right.
And then Apple started with iTunes. And then at that point, it was like, oh, this was inevitable, right? It was like, how naive to think that Apple Computer could not have anything to do with music. So then there had to be, at some point, the law, Apple Computer clearly broke the agreement completely. And of course, they had to. I mean, it was like billions and billions of dollars at stake, right? So another agreement had to be reached. And that agreement, that was negotiated by Steve Jobs, who, of course, is famously a huge Beatles fan. And
interesting.
He had the not only as part of the agreement, most likely Apple Inc. at that point paid Apple Corp. a ton of money, probably. But also they negotiated the agreement where the Beatles music came to Apple Music first, to iTunes first, actually.
Right. Right.
So that, they hadn't, the Beatles were not the last holdouts, but they were, starting to look like one of the last holdouts.
Right. Right.
Getting digitized at that time. And then it was kind of a coup. And now we even see that today with Apple Music prominently featuring this single Now and Then and the documentary and the video and all that as part of Apple Music. And Apple Music has had tons of Beatles content because they've been re-releasing albums as different anniversaries have hit with like remasters and using all sorts of the latest technology to not only produce clean, very clean tracks for all the songs, but also take the outtakes, the other versions. Like there's a great one of Revolver is fantastic. Revolver has basically, it's the original album and then like at least two versions of almost every song. And those versions are very different.
Like, oh, interesting.
You hear that because a lot of times when you get a rock album and it's like, oh, here's an alternate take of this. It's like the alternate take is like, oh, the violins are quieter or, there's one little verse that's different or something. This is like dramatically like early takes, like when they would go in and record something. And it was like, here's just one, whatever Beatle wrote it, just basically playing it for the rest. And it's like, well, the chorus is different, and they're playing guitars instead of, you know, all these instruments and all this, and they have that in there. So there's a bunch of these albums, and they're all on Apple Music. I assume they're on the other services as well.
By now, I would assume so too. Yeah,
fascinating to listen to the alternate takes of these well-known songs, and hearing the evil. It kind of demystifies them for me. You know, my whole life, you hear a song like Yellow Submarine or something, and it's like, there's just the song Yellow Submarine. That's it. There's like the official song. And now all of a sudden hearing like, oh, it sounded different on take three.
Right.
You know, they had different words and they were doing different things. And how bizarre to think at some point the song was in this state. And then they kept working on it to get to the thing that everybody knows and recognizes.
Yep. Fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ain't it cool? So we're going to continue the music theme, as it turns out.
Yeah, very much so.
So what I'm going to point folks at is a video on YouTube. It's actually a recording of Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. For those who don't know me well, that piece of music is, I would consider, my favorite piece of music of all time. This one, however, is a very interesting recording. It is played on what's called a bandoneon or a bandoneon. I'm not even sure the right pronunciation. That happens to be a type of concertina, which most people would incorrectly call an accordion. And it is extremely well done. I actually have listened to it twice so far just today after I ran across it just completely by accident this morning. So I just thought, you know, if there are any classical music buffs out there, normally we're used to hearing Toccata and Fugue in D minor on a pipe organ. And if you hear like the first few bars, you will recognize it instantly. In fact, I think that that's probably almost, I would say the first 15 seconds are what everybody knows. And then the rest of the music, nobody really listens that long, right? Mm-hmm. But if you actually listen to the whole thing, it's actually a very intricate, very interesting piece. And like I said, and this particular recording, this particular video made me realize how much of music, and indeed what you and I do every day, is nothing more than pushing buttons in the right order at the right time.
Yeah,
and that is specifically true for this instrument. One of the differences between it and an accordion, I think, is that it's one of those that has round buttons at the end instead of having a keyboard along one side of it. And you can see this guy is—that's what makes it work. He's doing all the button pushing in the right order. Anyway, in addition to that, I'll throw out a bonus. I actually have a YouTube playlist, a link in the show notes, of I think right now it's got about 28 recordings of Toccata and Fugue in D minor, ranging from the traditional, the best recordings on pipe organ, to some fairly, I'll just call them, unique recordings that struck me. So anyway, Toccata and Fugue in D minor, I like it.
Cool. Yeah, I was going to even include this as my Ain't It Cool, but then you brought up the other Beatles thing. So
right.
It turns out right now I'm finishing a book about the Beatles. I've read a lot of books about the Beatles over my life, even when I was a kid. I was fascinated with the Beatles history because they were just before my time. But the very recent past. And then my whole life I've loved Beatles music. So I've read lots of books. I know their history really well. But this book is just about the year 1966. It's called Beatles 66 by Steve Turner. And it is a very detailed look at that particular year, which was basically they started the year. They were still basically the Fab Four, making singles and, doing all that. And at the end of the year, they're basically about to start on Sgt. Pepper. And then the year mostly had them making the album Revolver, and really kind of expanding in many different artistic directions. So it's like the year that spans like that early Beatles Fab Four stuff to the later Beatles high creativity, albums and musical stuff. And it's fascinating to hear that. I've never heard this level of detail before. It's also the guy who wrote it's obviously a fan. I mean, but he doesn't pull any punches in terms of like talking about, the good and the bad that the Beatles were involved with. With a lot of histories I've read were always just like, this is written for the fans. You know, let's not talk about the drug use, that kind of thing. It very much goes into that and just an incredible level of detail I've never heard before. But it's all historical research. I mean, he's a historian. He's constantly quoting articles, interviews, things like that. And then he even makes a point, which was interesting, saying that a lot of Beatles history today is retold from interviews after the Beatles, in the 70s, 80s, 90s through today, where Beatles are recalling what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to take almost all of his material from things that were recorded and said that year.
Right.
And a lot of times they conflict. You know, this, we have information that this is what happened on this day in 1966. But then Paul, 25 years later, said it was something different. Hmm. It's like, okay, we're going to go with the original information and not Paul's 25-year-old recollection, right, you know, of what happened. So it's just fascinating stuff, and it's new depth, because 66 was like, they did Revolver, they had the whole like More Popular Than Jesus thing go on, they started playing different instruments and putting different instruments in their music, Revolver had things like Eleanor Rigby and all that, mm-hmm, in there. They started doing fashion, they started doing a lot of getting involved in the arts, and then the whole London scene, art scene, was exploding that year, and they were kind of, you know, at the center of that. So it's a really fascinating book, a little different than everything else I've read about the Beatles.
Cool.
Yep.
Yeah, and I honestly can't imagine an accurate Beatles history that doesn't talk about drug use.
Not necessarily
for the drug use itself, but it had a dramatic impact on their music.
Well, yeah, and in this, I mean, you know, there's some of the stuff, some of the songs are obviously, like in Revolver, like Tomorrow Never Knows and She Said, the lyrics are obviously about, you know, drugs and LSD mostly. After reading this, you come to the realization that almost all of the songs were about LSD. Literally, there's Taxman's about taxes. The rest of them are about LSD. So,
all right, this week, yeah, I want to point people at, why can't I talk to a real person? It is definitely a frustrating scenario that I hear from people all the time. They have an issue with, I don't know, pick your favorite free service, Gmail, Outlook.com, Yahoo, whatever, and there's nobody to talk to. And I delve into why that is, and some of the things that you can and cannot do about it. So why can't I talk to a real person? AskLeo.com/31060.
Cool. I'm going to point to a video that's not out yet, but it kind of pertains a little bit, or it's more current. And that's there's a thing going on now where Apple announced earlier in the week, we could have talked about this as a story, but there was a PR person at Apple actually said, no, we're not coming out with a 27-inch iMac. And until now, it's been rumored that there's no more 27-inch iMac. A lot of people like me have said, look, there's no 27-inch iMac coming out. Don't hold your breath. Right. But now an official Apple person has said, we are not working on a 27-inch iMac. So I created a video. Okay, give it up. Here's what you can get instead. Like, stop waiting for it. You still have great options, like a Mac Studio and the Apple Studio display, that kind of thing. Like, this is your 27-inch iMac. It's been in front of you the whole time, but now you can kind of give up waiting for an actual 27-inch iMac. So it's kind of a different video for me, and it's actually going to be coming out on Friday this week. So I'll include a link in the show notes here. But yeah, if you're listening to this before Friday, the link won't work.
All right, cool. Yeah. Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up for another week.
Yep.
Thanks, as always, for listening, everybody. We're going to let Adam take us out. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH209. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.